This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Colostrum LD from Sovereign Laboratories. Colostrum LD is clinically proven to maintain optimal immune function, eliminate harmful pathogens, and fight infection, as well as cleanse and prevent the absorption of toxins. Adding Colostrum LD daily to your diet provides the essential nutrition needed to maintain optimal health. To order, just go to SovereignLaboratories.com. That's SovereignLaboratories.com. If you're a first-time customer, you can get a full 5-day supply for free. Just go to SovereignLaboratories.com for Colostrum LD. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're talking to Dr. David Hyman. He's an MD and a JD, and he's an health policy expert, teaches at Georgetown. He is part of the Cato Institute. His book is Overcharged, Why Americans Pay Too Much for Healthcare. And, less people, look, this is a partisan discussion. There's no question that the battle lines are drawn about the direction healthcare should take in the future. But let me just read this quote from one of the reviewers of this book, Overcharged. It's from Tim Westmoreland, who's a professor of law at Georgetown University, one of Dr. Hyman's colleagues. It's, whether you are right, left, or center, you'll find something in this book to make you happy, something to make you angry, and because the writing is so good, something to make you laugh ruefully. Different people will have different views of the author's proposals, but no one will come away without new insight. And that's what I found about this book. It's got some persuasive arguments, it's got some revelations, and it's got some innovative solutions. We need to think out of the box because we're in trouble. You in the book say outright, and I'm quoting, Medicare is an intergenerational Ponzi scheme. How does that work?
I think we called it a pyramid scheme, if I'm not incorrect, but I could be wrong. The nature of Medicare and the people who don't like calling it an intergenerational pyramid scheme prefer to call it a sacred compact between the generations. Mm-hmm. But the reality
is, you take care
of
the elderly, it's part of our responsibility in society, et cetera, et cetera.
So the nature of Medicare, which was in some ways modeled on Social Security, is we will collect money from the population and we will use it to pay for some defined group, the elderly for both programs, and we will tell everyone that we are doing that as part of a ongoing statutory arrangement where when you fall into that category, you turn 65, we'll take care of you as well. That works fine as long as the working population is much larger than the retired population, and the costs, stay reasonably stable. Now, as our population has aged, the working population has actually become a smaller share of the overall population as people are retiring and living for a much longer period of time than they used to.
I think when Medicare was envisioned, I think the average age, the average longevity was in the 70s, making it a proposition for people over 65 wasn't, it was not too much of a stretch.
It was a reasonable thing to do, certainly. But what's different about Social Security is, there's a formula where the amount you're paid doesn't go up by a huge amount every year. It goes up by general inflation, if there's a COLA, cost of living adjustment, but that's about it. But that's not true of Medicare, right? Medicare is tied to the growth in healthcare spending, and the growth in healthcare spending has been way ahead of regular inflation for a long time, which is why, it's now 18% of our GDP when it used to be a much smaller share, certainly when the Medicare program got started. So you've got a double whammy, right? Or even a triple whammy. The share of the working population is smaller, you're paying it out for a longer period of time, and you're doing it for much more expensive things. And so the difficulty, is the numbers for Medicare in terms of the difference between what we have saved up and expect to collect versus the, expected spending gets to be gigantic.
Mm-hmm.
literally trillions of dollars in unfunded obligations.
You being a medical economist, you know, what are the projections? Is Medicare going under at some finite point in the future?
So, you know, the difficulty is, what do we mean by going under, right? So there's what's called the Part A Trust Fund, which is what people have tended to focus on. This is the amount of money that you're paying based on wages, right? It comes out of working people. It's a, you know, percentage of everybody's wages. And that pays for hospitalization for the senior citizens. But that's only a relatively modest share of the total Medicare spending, because it also spends money on physicians and outpatient services and drugs and managed care. And so when you look on an overall basis, the trust fund's a pretty small share of the total. But the trust fund has a convenient feature that allows people to focus on whether it has enough money, which is whether, you know, we have money, so to speak, in the bank compared to the amounts that we expect to spend. And so every year the trustees issue this report that says at some point in the future the trust fund's going to run out of money, mm-hmm. and then we'll only have the money that we're collecting on a year-to-year basis. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that number, you know, is typically, you know, 8 to 12 years in the future. And then after that date happens, there will still be money to pay for health care, but less than what we expect. And so we're going to need to dip into other taxes mm-hmm. to fund it. But we're already spending a lot of money from other sources to pay for the other parts of the Medicare program, which don't have a trust fund. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when people talk about bankruptcy, they're usually focusing on the trust fund. But that's only a small part of the problem.
Yeah, you know, I notice, you know, now that I'm Medicare, I just turned Medicare 65 last year, that the amount that you have to pay for your Medicare and your, you know, additional policy is geared to your income. So in effect, you have paid in at scale over the course of your career, but you're not really getting your money back. You're getting an opportunity to pay on a sliding scale for medical services going forward. Now, it's a terrific bargain because it's all a lot cheaper than my previous conventional insurance. You know, some people really feel that Medicare is sort of reneging on its commitment. You know, you paid in and then you don't get the money back.
Well, yes and no, right? So the sliding scale is an attempt to deal with the reality that some Medicare beneficiaries, you know, make more than others. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we're going to subsidize people, we want to try and focus the subsidies on the people that need it the most. But Medicare is, for the beneficiaries, a huge bargain, right? So the Medicare Part B, which covers physicians, patients are paying 25 cents on the dollar for the cost of the coverage that they're receiving. So what does that mean? It means the rest of the taxpayers are picking up the tab for that. And that's very expensive, right? Mm-hmm. But it's a great bargain for the beneficiaries. People who are on the receiving end of Ponzi schemes are very keen on Ponzi schemes, right? The short phrase is, the government that robs Peter to pay Paul can always depend on the support of Paul.
Yes.
And that's, you know, that's the challenge here is we have a huge group of people who have expectations mm-hmm. since they paid in over their life that they will receive Medicare when it comes time for them. But there's just not enough money.
Yeah, there's a constituency that's built up that, I mean, you know, that's the whole, you know, pushing grandma over the cliff meme that circulated around proposals to, you know, modify Medicare or help to underwrite its cost in a more sensible way. You know, it's like, don't touch my Medicare. Because
there is bipartisan opposition to changing Medicare in ways that gets the elderly upset.
Yep. It's the third rail of politics.
It's perfectly understandable, right? As I said, these are individuals who have settled expectations and they paid in. But, you know, the difficulty is if something can't go on forever, it won't. Sooner or later, we're going to have to make changes to this mm-hmm. that make it sustainable. And the longer we wait, the worse the problem is.
Indeed. Okay, folks, at this point, let's pause and let's allow one of our sponsors to share this important message with you. Did you know the benefits of nature's most powerful superfood are universal and always available no matter what your age? This is Dr. Ronald Hoffman with a nutritional supplement I recommend and use that's clinically proven to maintain optimal immune function, eliminate harmful pathogens, and fight infection, and cleanse and prevent the absorption of toxins. It's Colostrum LD from Sovereign Laboratories. Adding Colostrum LD daily to your diet provides the essential nutrition needed to maintain optimal health. With Sovereign's proprietary enhanced delivery system, Colostrum LD is the most effective colostrum available. Colostrum LD has wide-ranging health benefits at every stage of life. To order, just go to SovereignLaboratories.com. That's SovereignLaboratories.com. If you're a first-time customer, you can get a full 5-day supply for free. Just go to SovereignLaboratories.com for Colostrum LD. Thanks for listening. And thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what make Intelligent Medicine a free resource to you. And now back to our guest, Dr. David Hyman. And part of the problem is that drives the costs of Medicare is that, you know, we didn't envision all these medical breakthroughs we were going to make, you know, cancer drugs that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars a year that may sustain life for perhaps a few additional months. But, you know, people feel they're entitled to them. You know, drugs
let me correct you, Ron, if I could.
Sure.
They feel entitled to them as long as somebody else is footing the bill.
Okay. Exactly.
If they're spending their own money, they, I suspect, would behave very differently. Not all of them, but mm-hmm. some of them. And mm-hmm. that's fine. That's, if people are spending their own money, God love them. But mm-hmm. it doesn't follow that we should give them an open-ended invitation to raid the U.S. Treasury to pay for, you know, high-cost, low-value drugs. And the way to figure out whether patients actually value this is to let them spend their own money on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, you know, drugs are too expensive. And, you know, by comparison, you look at other countries. I mean, people are ordering comparables from India, from other countries where the drugs are cheaper. Some people are calling for drastic price controls. You know, let's take the pharmaceutical companies and transform them into public utilities serving the people. Because that's what it's all about, right? You know, and you know, harness that creative energy for the benefit of the populace. I think people are calling for that.
People are certainly calling for that. Many of them don't understand basic pharmacoeconomics. But that's not to suggest that there aren't serious problems with the market for drugs. The book has several chapters that talk about the problem, some of which are, you know, bad behavior by individual drug companies or responding to the incentives where, you know, the example I give people is if you sat across the table from your boss and he said to you, what would you like to get paid next year? And it didn't matter which number you said, that's what you get paid. Well, that's how we structured parts of the drug market.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what? They want more money because you're willing to pay it. Because there's an open-ended reimbursement. The book also talks about ways in which the FDA has, you know, had created problems in the market for pharmaceuticals. And we have a variety of suggestions on ways to fix those problems.
By making it so expensive to develop drugs? Is that one of the ways?
Well, that's one of the ways. But another important way is they restrict entry sometimes because they have other regulatory objectives and sometimes because they just haven't gotten around to approving another generic competitor. So you remember Martin Shkreli?
Oh, yeah.
The guy who everybody wanted to punch him.
Pharma Bro
for raising the price of a drug called Daraprim,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, huge price increase, although the drug was used by only a couple of thousand people. So in terms of its impact on total drug spending, it was, you know, effectively zero.
Mm-hmm.
But he was doing something lots of other pharma companies had done as well. But he was able to do it because he was the only person supplying the drug in the United States. The FDA hadn't approved anybody else, and they kept everybody else off the market.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So Shkreli had market power only because the FDA allowed him to have it. right? If they just approved reimportation of other, you know, suppliers of the drug, and the drug had been generic for decades, it wasn't like, you know, there was any property interest that we were trying to protect.
It's like $600 EpiPens, things like that, you know, where, you know, it's a cheap drug, somehow through some patent shenanigans or, you know, regulatory hoops, they managed to corner the market on a very inexpensive supplement, a drug that it's via the delivery system, the injector, the auto injector, I guess, was the issue.
Right. The book talks about that example as well, and the way in which the manufacturers use the government processes to keep other providers off the market.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let's talk about Medicaid, okay? Because, again, there are calls for expansion of Medicaid because, frankly, in this country, there's still people who are not covered by health insurance. Health insurance should be available even to the indigent. We have a disadvantaged and poor population. We have immigrants, aka sometimes you know, not documented folks in this country. And the proposal is that we extend Medicaid to more and more people because that's you know, low cost healthcare.
And just, do you want me to comment on that?
I'm throwing you a high hanging curveball to hit out the park.
So Medicaid is inexpensive in one sense, which is that it pays a relatively modest amount per unit of service, much less than pretty much any other insurer, public or private, in the market. Right? Yep. But it doesn't follow that you can find someone that will treat you other than at the local hospital emergency room. Mm-hmm. Some states have had better luck with others than this. But what I used to tell medical students when I would teach them is, if you think Medicaid translates into access, pick up the phone, call five physicians ask them when the next appointment is, and then tell them that you have Medicaid and see how it affects the answer.
Yeah. Absolutely. Right. I mean, I don't know any of my colleagues who accept Medicaid. I mean, there are certain doctors who specialize in that, but they sort of game the system to do mass treatment, you know, big volume, and it's kind of like an assembly line, and they know how to code properly to squeeze a few little bit of lard out of the gnat, which is Medicaid reimbursement.
So that, you know, that we should view that as a real problem. These are, you know, our fellow Americans, and the book basically says we should help them, and we should help them by giving them money and letting them decide if they want to buy insurance that looks like Medicaid, or they want to buy better insurance, or they want to go into the self-pay market and buy catastrophic coverage. Right? Medicaid is actually very comprehensive insurance, but it pays at such a low level it's difficult for many people to access the healthcare system.
I guess you're not a fan of the universal mandate, or the what is, you know, the crux of Obamacare, which is that everybody has got to opt for some form of insurance.
So if you're an insurance company, you want nothing more than the government to tell everyone they have to do business with you. Mm-hmm. It's not at all clear why selling expensive / overpriced insurance that covers everything to everybody is the system we ought to want. Our argument is that people's preferences vary. People should have catastrophic coverage because you don't want people to be wiped out. But all the bells and whistles that upper middle class people want in their coverage, and that healthcare providers want to make sure they buy, and that insurers want to make sure they buy, is not at all what people should want because people's preferences differ.
You know, I have a little bit of a dog in the fight, which is, you know, I am myself a medical nutritionist and an integrative physician. That means I try to use natural approaches where possible to prevent and alleviate disease. And generally, these are relatively low-cost approaches because they don't involve high-tech surgery or pharmaceutical intervention. Your book, I don't believe, addresses that to a large extent. Do you think that the emphasis on high-tech fixes in medicine in the U.S. is part of the problem?
I think the answer is it could be. It depends on the specifics, right? There's lots of interest in prevention, and lots of people think prevention, you know, has all of the answers. I think there are some things that you can prevent. Mm-hmm. There are other things for which the high-tech cure is exactly what you want, and what people will value. I think, again, people's preferences vary. Some people, you know, live their lives trying to avoid any and all illnesses. Other people engage in all sorts of reckless behavior. Yep. That's part of the wonderful thing about the United States of America, is we allow people to make their own decisions about those things.
Well, you know, part of the argument against universal health care or sort of comprehensive coverage is that it sort of eliminates moral hazard, which is a factor that sometimes guides people in their behavior. Some people say, well, you know, I'll just keep on doing whatever it is I'm doing because I'm covered. It'll get handled.
So I like to ski, and I assume a known risk of bad things happening. But, you know, I would be very reluctant to allow some busybody to tell me no more skiing because we've concluded it's unduly risky for you. Mm-hmm. And the same, it seems to me, applies across a whole host of behavior, right? Mm-hmm. There are people who go to the gym a lot more than I do. There are people who go less than I do. I don't view that as giving me a reason why I should be able to tell other people how often they should go to the gym. And
but you assume responsibility for your actions because, you know, in the event that you have a broken hip and, you know, you're disabled, you know, maybe you carry some sort of personal disability insurance, you know, which I have done, you know, during the course of my professional career, or you self-insure, you save some money and you say, hey, you know, if I can't work, I got this covered. It won't be a calamity. It won't be an utter disaster. I won't have to, you know, go into medical bankruptcy, which is also the specter that a lot of people raise. You know, people in this country go into medical bankruptcy because of medical costs.
If you're worried about medical bankruptcy, the solution is to get the cost of healthcare down. It's not to try and give more people more expensive insurance that will increase the cost of healthcare.
Because it's an upward spiral. It's a never-ending
upward spiral. It's an upward spiral. Yep. You'll just be chasing it forever.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one of the central messages that's in this book, Overcharged, Why Americans Pay Too Much for Healthcare. And it's in great detail. It goes over some of the problems that we're facing. And however we intend to solve them politically, we need some answers. And there's some answers in the book. So I want to thank you very much for joining us and being part of an effort to find solutions. I hope that your book has a widespread influence among policymakers. Are you talking to people in Congress about your ideas? Do you actually have some people who are carrying water for some of your proposals?
So I've talked to some people, and I testified at a hearing a couple of months ago. So, you know, people are listening. There's, I think, broader agreement on the problems than there is on the solutions. But as long as people are talking about it, I'm hopeful.
Okay. Well, great. Thank you very much, Dr. David Hyman. The book is Overcharged, Why Americans Pay Too Much for Healthcare. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Hi, this is Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Many of us wonder sometimes what's going on with our brains, like when we can't recall a name that should be totally familiar to us or forget why we went into the kitchen. These worries take on a little more weight as we grow older. That's why I've created the Intelligent Medicine Brain Health Protocol, my personal supplement recommendations to slow cognitive decline and enhance memory and mental performance. Just go to drhoffmanstore.com. In addition to the Brain Health Protocol, you'll find easy-to-follow links for my Supplement Starter Kit, Heart Health Protocol, and much more. These protocols are an easy way for you to get the exact combination of targeted supplements you need to help you follow the intelligent medicine lifestyle. And for a limited time, you'll get free shipping on all of your store orders. For more details, just go to drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com.